review of my presentation yesterday, let me read to you two sections from the Sermon on the Mount. The first one is found in the fifth chapter of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, in the 15th verse. When a lamp is lit, it is not put under the meal tub, but on the lampstand, where it gives light to everyone in the house. And the other passage, also from the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6, verses 22 and 23, the lamp of the body is the eye. If your eyes are sound, you will have light for your whole body. If the eyes are bad, your whole body will be in darkness. If then the only light you have is darkness, the darkness is doubly dark. I have been asked by one or two of you to suggest to you some reading, some literature that may guide you further into the adventure of biblical archaeology. Fortunately, I'm able to make some recommendations here because the American Schools of Oriental Research, which is an umbrella organization for seminaries, museums, and universities interested in biblical archaeology, is publishing a very good journal. It is called The Biblical Archaeologist. Let me write it to the blackboard.
But friends, I haven't located the chalk.
I think it's up on the top. On the right end.
Is that in the
right? Right there.
No, that's a piece of tape. Deceptively looks like it, doesn't it? Well, like yesterday, maybe it will be found in some excavations. The Biblical Archaeologist is a journal published 2-3 times a year by the American Schools of Oriental Research, and it keeps you abreast with work done in biblical archaeology and related lands, such as ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt. There is a very good selection of articles from the Biblical Archaeologist available in paperback form, published by Doubleday, called The Biblical Archaeologist Reader. The Biblical Archaeologist Reader. 3 volumes, paperbacks, and these I can highly recommend because here the best articles from the Biblical Archaeologist through the years have been selected. And you can, thank you very much, you can there probe into how ancient cities were built, how libraries were made up, how ancient manuscripts were written. You can read about Sodom and Gomorrah, if that interests you, or about the manna in the wilderness, and many more topics of that kind. You can pick and choose, and I'm sure you will find something for your taste almost every time you turn to it. There must be 60 articles, some longer, some shorter, collected there. The Biblical Archaeologist is the journal. The Biblical Archaeologist Reader is this selection in 3 paperback volumes. Then I would like to recommend to you a volume written by George Ernest Wright, who last taught at Harvard, a biblical archaeologist, who attempted a synthesis of the results of biblical archaeology with the study of biblical and extra-biblical literary traditions. It deals with Shechem, the city about 40 miles north of Jerusalem that has been dug first by German archaeologists and later by the Drew McCormick expedition. It is called Shechem, the Biography of a Biblical City. The Biography of a Biblical City by George Ernest Wright. There are several other paperbacks that one can recommend. There is one by Miller Burroughs, who taught at Yale for a long time, called What Mean These Stones? Miller Burroughs. What Mean These Stones? There is one by Kathleen Canyon on archaeology in Palestine. Kathleen Canyon, the Dean of British Biblical Archaeologists. And I can recommend still others, more detailed ones. Now, I trust that this suffices, but please, if you have further questions, feel free to check with me afterwards. Now, my presentation today picks up from where I left yesterday, but it moves into a somewhat different key. What I would like to show to you today and tomorrow is my collection of originals and replicas which highlight, which illuminate, illustrate daily life in ancient Israel and in the time of the early church and the early rabbis. In other words, I would like to show you fragments or whole pieces from which archaeologists reconstruct the material culture of that part of the ancient world. My presentation is divided into five parts, and I intend to do three today and two tomorrow. The first part deals with daily life itself. Daily life itself. And I will show you some seven remains which illustrate this in one way or another. Then the second part deals with architecture. In other words, how the ancient Israelites housed themselves, how they built their houses, what they were made of, and what still remains of it. Then the third part will deal with an aspect of life that is always part of life, namely trade and commerce. Trade and commerce. And here we have, surprisingly, many remains that illustrate that feature. Then tomorrow, by way of preview, I would like to deal with, sorry to say, warfare and what remains of that. And then fifthly, I will deal with the realm of religion and remains of that sphere and aspect of life. Let me now deal with the first one. And again, it is, as yesterday, a show and tell session. This time, it comes in a red box. Now, easily, the most basic remain, if you wish, of any life is the soil on which it moves. When you come to Israel, and normally you will come by plane from the Mediterranean, you will cross the coastal strip, and you will soon see the very lush olive and orange groves which the Israelites have planted there. Some, of course, existed before the Israelites came into the land in modern times. But the more you move into the land, into the central hills and down into the Jordan Valley, you see that the soil has a reddish tinge to it, sometimes outright red. In fact, the Hebrew word for soil literally means the red one. That's where it is etymologically derived from. Now here I have a sample of what we call terra rosa. It is the Latin technical term for this reddish soil, which is on the whole decomposed limestone. The white limestone decomposes into this reddish soil. It is very fertile. Especially the olive tree and the fig tree likes it. And so you have thriving groves of fig trees and olive trees all across the land. Again, you are welcome to inspect this later. Now, the second item I have brought along is what the soil brings forth, and that is grain, after some hard work, of course. We hear of that already in the first chapters of the Bible. What I have here are carbonized kernels of wheat and or barley and little chickpeas. These we found last summer in a storage room of one of the houses that we dug. They come from the middle of the 4th century, and due to certain favorable conditions, they did not decompose but became carbonized, in other words, like charcoal, in fact. You can see them here, hold them up against the light and study them, but this is what wheat and chickpea looked like from the 4th century of our era. The next item I would like to show you is this, and maybe you can identify this for me. Now let me tell you first, it's stone. It's also nicely rounded. You may see that one side is rubbed quite smooth, the other one not as much. It's basalt. So any one of you, any idea what this might be?
A grinding?
Right, it's a grinding stone. It's a grinding stone made of basalt found still today on the Golan Heights, on the other side of the Jordan. In fact, that area looks very dark because it's mostly that dark basalt stone, not the white limestone you have on this side of the Jordan. We have found quite a few of these. sometimes together with fragments of the round platter, also made from basalt, which was used to grind herbs or other condiments. You can see that this side was the one that was used for grinding. It has been rubbed smooth. Archaeologically, these things are interesting finds, but not too useful because the forms do not change much. Still today, you might see an Arab woman grinding condiments, spices for the food with such a grinding stone. You see, I suppose it could still be sold in the market. There, I could bring this one along. I have seen, by the way, a similar procedure in India. The next one you also may be able to identify for me. They are in these plastic bags, and that may make it difficult to see it. You may, however, make out that this is a flint stone that has been chipped into the shape of a knife. In fact, this is a kitchen knife that may have been used for many generations. Again, they are archaeologically not too important because they do not change in the course of the centuries, so don't tell us too much about the actual century from which it comes. But it is a good example of a knife, and it has been rather well worked. You can still make out the blade, at least that's what we would call it here. The next item is something of which you probably have heard.
Broken dishes.
Right, broken dishes. These are the famous sherds, which for the earlier periods, before coins were minted, are really our most important indicator as to the period from which the particular sherd comes, and then, since we normally know where it was found, of the layer in which it was found. Now, let me read these sherds for you. There's a little bit of cheating in it, because with India ink, each is already identified. And over the India ink is some nail polish. The archaeologists use a lot of nail polish, because that then protects the India ink, you see, and it stays on there. All these pieces, by the way, I found loose, so they are archaeologically useless. They were no more in context, and I simply picked them up for teaching purposes such as these. Now, the oldest one here is this piece. It may be difficult for you from a distance to identify it. All of these are indicator sherds. In other words, sherds either from the base or the rim or the handle. You see, one of them or two of them are body sherds, but that has a special reason. Now, you may be able to make out that this here is a base. It stood like this. You see, it still stands quite nicely like this. It belonged to a storage jar. No. It was identified here as a bowl. In other words, it was open like this. Probably a rather big one. This could easily be determined on the basis of the curvature. It is not wheel turned. There are no traces of the wheel on this. And therefore, already on that score, it has to be identified as coming from the early Bronze Age. In other words, this bowl was shaped by a potter more than 4,000 years ago. The next item here is this one. Now, maybe you are able to tell me what this is.
The handle.
Right, it is a handle. It is a handle, a double handle, in fact, of the two pieces stuck together. Occasionally you find even three. It comes from the Middle Bronze Age, in other words, the times of the patriarchs, in terms of biblical history. It's a pitcher handle found at Shechem from the Middle Bronze Age. The next item is this one here. Maybe you can tell me what this is. That's very substantial. It is pointed here. And that's not a bad guess. Now, look to the other side of the vessel.
The bottom.
Right, it's the bottom of a storage jar. Now, you may be surprised that this should be the bottom of a storage jar.
Mm-hmm.
But the storage jars, generally the jars in ancient Israel and also in the preceding Canaanite periods, all had pointed bases. For the simple reason that their floors were not hard floors like ours, where you need a flat base, but were usually clay floors, you see. And if you wanted to securely put down such a jar, you dug a little hole in it, maybe only an inch or two deep, close to the wall, and you would set it in there, you see, and lean it against the wall. When you wanted to pour out, you would simply tilt it, you see. It was quite functional in that sense. This is a very substantial one. That's the late bronze storage jar base. You can tell from the thickness of the walls that it must have stood easily this high. And maybe it was the family water supply, or the wine was kept in there. I suspect, though, it was the family water supply. Here is another one. Oops, I've gone a little bit out of order here. Maybe you can tell me what this is. That's clearly a rim. Now, how did it stand? Like this, or this, or this? Well, this is the way to determine it. You have a flat surface, and you see where it closes. Now, it doesn't close here at all. It doesn't. There it does. It stood like this. All right? It must have been a very big vessel. It was a storage jar, a big one. You can tell from the curvature that the mouth must have been rather big. And there's a peculiar feature about this. We call these storage vessels hole mouth jars, H-O-L-E. Why? Because when you look down on them, the opening looks like a black hole. And that is why archaeologists have called that type hole mouth jars. As often it happens, some of the names are rather arbitrary and are connected with some circumstances when they were first found, hence that somewhat odd name. The next item is this, and that is probably also easy to identify. Again, here you have a rim. Now, this rim stood straight up, more or less. Yeah, like this, slightly curved inward. You have to know what it is. It is a cooking pot. The cooking pots had this very typical lip here, and people could pick it up here. Many of the cooking pots, especially when you come further down, are blackened by soot and from the fire. They are also very well fired. This comes from the early Iron Age, a cook pot rim. In other words, from the time of the judges or King David. Then here I have another item. You can tell that this belonged to a big bowl. And again, it stood like this. In other words, it was wide, roughly like this. It was probably used as a meal dish. You know that, or maybe you can gather from some references in the Old and the New Testament, that the meal was made in that a bowl was set into the middle and everybody went into it with his or her hand and picked out what he or she wanted. He who dips his hand with me into the bowl, you know, from the story of the betrayal of Judas. So this would have been one of these bowls. This is of somewhat better quality. I can tell that because it is ring burnished. And burnishing is a special finishing procedure for pottery. Those of you who have done pottery probably know about this. It makes the vessel somewhat harder and more valuable. Then I have here an item that is quite different from the others. What stands out right away is the beautiful red color and the fine white paste. This is very well known from ancient Israel. It is fineware, in other words, more expensive ceramic that was made in Samaria, the capital of the Northern Kingdom, in the Iron II period, roughly the time of the prophet Amos. This was the tableware that was used in the well-to-do houses across the land, but especially in Samaria, the capital. Hence it is called Samariaware. It is highly burnished. It is not glazed, but highly burnished. Then we come to a later period. This is the handle of a cook pot from the Roman period. Now you see, the earlier cook pots did not have handles. 1,000 years later, under the influence of Greek and Roman forms, the cook pot gets a handle and is curved further inward. This is a cook pot handle from the Roman period. This is a straightforward body shirt from the Roman period. Originally, I cleaned it in order to write a message on it. But then I decided that I had more to say than would go onto this little space, and so I kept it just for the fun of it. It is a body shirt. However, it is useful for our purposes in that you have the ribbing running across the outside, which is typical for Roman age pottery. And here there is also a Roman age body shirt that has some decoration on it that has stayed through the centuries. Now these are the very humble pottery finds with which archaeologists work, and what I have done here for you now is I have quote-unquote read the pottery, you see. Let me move to the next item, and that is a replica. Maybe you can tell me what this is.
Safety pin.
Very good. Yes, this is in principle a safety pin. The pin part here is missing, but you have even the spring here, and of course it's much bigger here. Can you also guess for what this was probably used?
Diapers.
Oh, they had a much simplified system. Junior went bare from here on. Finished. No, this is for clothes. Right. You see, the ancients wore a heavy shawl that could be used at night for covering, during the day as a coat if necessary. And when it was cold, it would be pulled around and closed in the front, and you would need a big pin like this in order to hold it together. It's a fibula that was also used by the ancient Germans. I've seen it in museums in Germany with reference to that culture. Another way of holding clothes, such a shawl, together would be a big pin, and that we have also found. But that was used in ancient Israel. And finally, I have a lot of it, I didn't bring all of it. You can probably tell me what this is from the sound already. This is glass. This is Roman glass. The Phoenicians are credited with having invented the glass. This well may be so. In ancient Israel, glass was not in use. In fact, there is no biblical Hebrew word for glass. Of course, there's a modern Hebrew word. But there's no biblical word for glass. But in the time of the New Testament, glass was widely used. I have here both cast glass and blown glass. And you can inspect these pieces. Many of them have now a patina on them that reflects in different colors. Now these are the humble remains I have to offer you under item one, daily life, you see. And they are very humble indeed. Yes, please.
How did they use glass in the New Testament?
In New Testament times, there is no reference in the New Testament, to my knowledge, to glass. It was used for vessels, usually by well-to-do families. It was probably also used in palaces for windows. These are the major uses of which I am aware at this point. But in the museum in Jerusalem and elsewhere, you see some very beautiful vessels. And there were glass blowers across the Roman Empire that produced the vessels. Other questions? Yes, please.
Do you find that most of the pottery, or if it was glazed, inside or out?
Yeah, all the pottery is unglazed, except Arab pottery. The glazing of pottery was only done by the Arab potters. And it's almost a rule of thumb, if you find glazed pottery, it's Arab. That means 640 or later. The earlier people did not glaze pottery, they did burnish it, and you can study that here. Yes. Other questions?
I have a question about the knife.
Yes.
Is that... They're used in that small?
Yes. Well, that's as big as they came. Sometimes they would tie a handle to it. And I will show you tomorrow an arrowhead that is made from flint too, in the same way. But that was all they had. Imagine cutting meat with that. Now, bigger knives have been found, but generally cherts, that's what we call them, C-H-E-R-T, come in that size. I have seen some bigger ones too. Other questions? All right then, let me move to the second section, namely architecture. And here the first thing I would like to show you is a very common building material of which we also hear in the Old Testament. It's very humble. It is mud brick. In other words, bricks that were dried in the sun. They also fired bricks, but they were much more expensive and probably only used for building palaces and temples. It crumbles easily. It's surprising, though, how well it can stand up when you have a lot of it. I have seen city walls from the Middle Bronze Age made of mud brick, and they are as strong still as a rock. The most common building material, of course, was stone. And here I have two samples of limestone. One is crumbling a bit already. The other one I chipped out of a bigger piece of rock, and it is very hard and sound still. Now, rock is everywhere in the land of Canaan. And of course, you know that one of the temptation stories invites Jesus to turn these stones into bread. There were many stones there. Okay, then I have here another stone product, but it has been worked. You can see that this is roughly like a cube, a big one here and a little one here. These we call with the Latin word tessare, tessere, tessera is the singular, dressed paving stones. They were used in the Roman period, not before. Sometimes the ancient Israelites did pave their courtyards, but then with much bigger flagstones. When you have colored stones and put them into a pattern, of course you get a mosaic, you see. The bigger ones were probably used for outside courtyards, the smaller ones within the houses. The next item, maybe you can identify for me. Now it's clearly made from ceramic, but it is not a pot. That is not the case. Sorry?
A shelf.
A shelf? Well, not a bad idea.
A column?
Well, I'll tell you, it was like this, and it was big like this.
Roof tile,
right. It's a roof tile from the 4th century, and still in Europe you find, especially in southern countries, you find roof tiles made that way. You see, here it was hung against a bar, and then the next one down and or up, as the case may be. They were easily this long, and these are rather well fired. We picked up a lot of them last summer, and at one point I collected them all, hoping I would have time to do a little study of 4th century roof tiles in Upper Galilee, but I didn't get to it. Then here I have another item that is probably the latest one of them all. This is a piece of painted plaster, wall plaster, from the synagogue in Gush Halav, which we also dug. Surprisingly, it is decorated with water-soluble paint, which has been preserved through the centuries. When I cleaned it up and I used a wet cloth, I began to take it off, and then, of course, I quickly stopped the procedure. But it was preserved in such a way that water could not get at it. Therefore, you still have it there. You can come and inspect it and see how well done it is. Certainly as well done as in some of our modern houses, perfectly smooth. Then the next item you probably will be able to identify for me. Well, it is difficult, I would say. It's a nail. It's or what remains of a nail. These nails were made by Smith. Nails were, on the whole, not used to hold houses together. They were used as pegs in the wall to hang things on. And we have found them occasionally. If you want to have an interesting and humorous illustrations as to how pegs, nails were used, you should read the second half of the 22nd chapter of Isaiah, where the prophet makes fun of a high royal official who came into the good graces of the king, and then, thinking that he had a good thing going, brought in his whole family and supplied them with jobs at the royal court too. But Isaiah says, "You have overdone it. You are like a pig put into the wall on which one hangs too many pots. The whole thing comes crashing down." Fine. And then I have here another item that is very difficult to identify. It is a piece of a tanur. A tanur is the Hebrew word for the baking oven in which the bread was baked. Every house had a baking oven in the open courtyard in the corner. It was approximately this high and shaped like a beehive. It had an opening at the top, a little one, and a round one on floor level. It was filled with dry shrubbery and then lit and heated, quickly swept out, and then the bread put in and all that closed up. The heat was absorbed by this special clay, you see, that made up the walls and then baked the bread. And here you have a piece of tanur of that wall. It is a red clay that was specially prepared and was not found everywhere in Palestine. Then I come to item number three, namely trade and commerce. And here I have several items, most of them replicas, even though the most valuable one is an original. Now, for any trade to be carried on, you need a system of weights. And what you have here is a replica of a 4-shekel weight. It is very regularly formed. It has on top 2 letters, Hebrew letters, that indicate that it is a 4-shekel weight. The shekel was approximately 2/5 of an ounce, 11.4 grams, so that this would come to approximately 45 grams, an ounce and a half. Later, when coinage was introduced, the shekel became the name for the most basic coin. It was then the temple tax in the time of Jesus and Paul. That's what Paul went collecting. You read that in 2 Corinthians, you see. But that was a very basic unit, and you will later see, in a few minutes, a shekel coin, roughly from the time of Jesus. Another very important item in all trade and commerce is a man's, or for that matter, a woman's signature. You know that nothing, at least a bigger deal, can be completed without the valid, or maybe even notarized, signature of those engaged in the trade. Now, most of the ancients could not write. They had scribes to do that for them. When they wanted to sign a document, say a real estate transfer, or a grain deal, or a cotton deal for that matter, that's where we have found it too, cotton coming from India, they would seal the document. A little piece of soft clay would be attached to the document, and then a seal impression made. What I have here is a scarab seal. Scarab is a technical term. It refers to a seal that is in the shape of a dung beetle. It comes from ancient Egypt. That was their custom. And you can inspect it here. On the one side, it looks like a perfect beetle. It is made from faience. A hole was drilled through it, and there's still some green copper in there. Evidently, it was carried on a copper chain or copper wire. On the other side, you have cut in the picture of a mountain goat of 2 palm branches, and all scarabs had it, the Egyptian Ankh sign, the sign for life. They are always on these scarabs. It comes from the early late Bronze Age, well, let's say around 1500 BCE, was found in a tomb near Hebron, so my antiquities dealer tells me, and miracle of miracles, it still works perfectly. If you give me a little piece of soft clay or plasticine I don't like so much because it gets stuck within it, but a soft, good quality soft clay, you can make an impression with it that is as sharp as made with a pin. Now, of this there exists only one, you see, that was cut for a person, probably not a terribly rich man to judge by the size and the symbols on it, but still, I have seen in the Negev a group of desert or mountain goats deep down in a wadi near some low-slung palm plants, very much like this. The next item is something that needs to be explained. Again, it is in this protective covering. It is the top of a jar handle. And you can see that here the jar was, and this is the handle. Now, all this is not unusual, except that it has an impression on top here. It is an eagle, or at least a bird-shaped impression. And to make a long story short, it was an official measuring jug that was used when people brought their tribute or taxes to the royal treasury, according to the royal weight. The description here, a royal seal impression, the oval seal impression on the jar handle contains a symbol with the word Lamelech, above and place names Memshat below, written in ancient Hebrew script. Lamelech is perfectly good Hebrew and means belonging to the king. Such royal seal impressions are frequently found on sites in Judah and Benjamin. They bear, in addition to the symbol and the word Lamelech, the name of one of four towns: Hebron, town you well know, Soko, Sif, also known to us from the Bible, or Memshat. The symbol is either a four-winged beetle or a two-winged sign called winged sun disk or flying scrolls. Opinions differ as to the significance of the four towns appearing on the stamped handbooks, and scholars have advanced several theories. A. Royal store cities, where taxes were levied, or cities where royal potteries produced vessels of guaranteed standard capacity, or key cities in the four defense districts of Judah, the jars were intended for storing supplies for times of siege. And then finally, the most important medium of exchange in trade and commerce, coins. They, however, appeared only from approximately the 4th century BCE onwards, first in Asia Minor, but then spread like wildfire. The Persians minted gold coins, they were widely used, but only for big transactions. Gradually, silver coins came in use, and then also copper coins. I thought I had bought a silver coin from the time of Alexander for all too much money. I showed it to a friend who is a professor at the university in Haifa and a numismatist. He looked at it and looked at it and looked at it and said, "Is the weight right?" I said, "Yes, I weighed it. It's only a fraction of a gram off." He said, "You know what? It's a fake. An ancient fake. An ancient fake." Human nature, huh? All right, the oldest of the coins, these are all replicas. No, half of them are replicas and half of them are originals. The oldest one here is a replica of an Alexander coin, minted shortly after Alexander died in Akko. On the one side, you have the head of Hercules. That's what Alexander liked on his coins. Maybe he saw himself as Hercules. And on the other side, you have a good Athenian motif, the goddess Athene seated on a throne with the owl of Athens. So you can't get more Hellenistic, I say. The next item to show you is this tiny copper coin, also a replica, with a menorah on it in the seven-branched candlestick. It is one of the coins of the Maccabees, who in the 2nd century BCE succeeded in shaking off the foreign yoke and establishing an independent Israel. In modern Israeli history, it's reported as the First War of Independence. The next item is a coin roughly from the time of Jesus. It is an original. It is one of the famous denarii, a denarius, a silver coin. This one is not terribly well preserved. It is minted during the period of Emperor Vespasian. This bell tells us that we have to stop. But that is the famous denarius of which also the New Testament speaks. Four more items here. One shekel coin from the end of the Second Temple period, from 69 of the Common Era. You see, here you have the shekel weight, actually it's four shekels, and then here you have a shekel coin. Then here a very well-known Roman coin that was minted by the Romans when they had finally conquered Judea and subjugated them. It is the Judea Capta coin, where you have on the one side a picture of Vespasian, the victorious Roman emperor, and on the other side a woman sitting in depression under a palm tree, symbolizing Judah, the kingdom that has been conquered, with a Roman soldier standing behind her. The Roman triumph speaks out of these coins. And then two well-preserved copper coins from the 4th century, one from Constantinus, in fact both from Constantine the Great, with all their titles. Each is identified as to where and when it was minted. Both of them are well preserved. That brings us to the end of our session today. I have illustrated through these finds these three areas: daily life, architecture, and trade and commerce in the times of the Bible, the Old and the New Testament. And these are the kind of remains with which the archaeologists work in order to put together their three-dimensional puzzle. Thank you very much.